This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. We received a lot of positive feedback from all of our listeners this last week, and we appreciate that. The number one piece of feedback that we received was that you'd like to know a little bit more about the panelists, so we thought we'd take a few minutes to introduce ourselves. Jim, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I was born and raised in the church. I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada. Went on my mission to Minnesota and Wisconsin, Iowa, a little bit of Canada, and thoroughly learned a lot on my mission. Some things good, some things that would come into play later in my life when I decided to leave the church. Was married in the temple after returning from my mission, and left Las Vegas to move to the Mid-South. I work in IT in the hospitality industry. And my history with leaving the church, I've been out roughly 5 years now, and I left her a very intensive year to year and a half, the course of picking up every book that I could think of that I could find to just learn more. And once I completed that process and decided to stop attending, you know, it changed my life for the better. I'm out now. I still have a interest in Mormonism when it comes to the history and the culture of the church, and also I have still a link with the church, as my family, both immediate and extended, are still heavily involved with the church. So that's me in a nutshell.
Great, thanks, Niall. How about you?
I was born into families, goodly parents, and I was raised very well in the church, and I really didn't have a lot of problems with it. I did not serve a mission, but I did get married in the temple. I was fully active at least up until the last year or so, when the church just didn't seem to fulfill me spiritually. And I kind of feel like the cognitive dissonance got too much, and so I eventually sort of left the church in my mind before finally resigning it officially earlier this year. So I've only been out of the church for a handful of months. I come from a strong pioneer stock, and I'm very proud of my Mormon heritage and prouder still of my Mormon family. And as many criticisms as I have of the organization, there's a lot of things about it that I still fundamentally respect. I'm trained in history and anthropology, although I think everyone sort of claims a piece of those two interests as well. I've spent a lot of time in Scandinavian studies and things like that. Other than that, that's all I can say.
Great. Tom, how about you?
Okay, yeah, my name's Tom. Born and raised in the church, pioneer ancestry on both sides. I'm even related to Hosea Stout, who was the chief of police in Nauvoo. Of course, through polygamy, I've got polygamy on both sides, both my mom and my dad's side of my family. Spent most of my life in Utah County, and I still live in Utah County. I served a mission and came home honorably, got married in the temple about a year and a few months later in the Salt Lake Temple, and served lots of different callings in the church, from anywhere from Elders Quorum Presidency or Elders Quorum President, the Executive Secretary, been on a high council, ward clerk, lots of different callings that I've been in. And then in late 2007, 2008, I started to do some research of the church and kind of had a crisis of faith, so to speak, and stopped going to church for a little while, and kind of got involved with you know, focused on Mormon studies and Mormon history and Mormon research, and I'm still very focused, and that's kind of my side hobby is Mormonism and all things Mormon. So, but I've found my way to continue to go back to church. I'm active right now. I even went to church today, in fact. So that's me. I live in Utah County and I'm active. So that's me.
Thanks. Our fourth panelist, George, who is on the first podcast, is not here tonight. We'll have him introduce himself next time. As for me, I was born and raised in the church, born and raised in the along the Wasatch Front. Both sides of my family go way back, all the way to, on the one side, all the way up to Upper State, New York, 1834. The other side were part of the Scandinavian influx in the 1860s. Went on a mission, served honorably, came back, graduated from BYU, was married in the temple, have served lots of callings. My wife and I sort of have together, I'd say drifted out of the church, but that sounds worse. We did a lot of studying, a lot of thought, a lot of prayer. We are still members, but we no longer attend nor believe. And we currently attend the Unitarian Church with our two children, but we're only kind of a Jack Unitarians. Okay, today we have the privilege of speaking to Jason, who has been a prominent figure in online Mormonism for some time and would be labeled by many as a critic. Jason, who goes by the online moniker of Dr. Shades, is the visionary behind the Mormon Discussions board and the author of MormonInformation.com website. Among his writings, Jason has proposed that there is a real difference between the Mormonism that is publicly represented on the internet and the Mormonism that most Mormons in the pews believe. Jason presented his ideas at Sunstone a few years back, and Jason's writings on the topic have been influential enough that FAIR has devoted a whole page to a refutation. By the way, we'll have links to all the material we're talking about tonight on our webpage. Welcome to the program, Jason.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Jason, maybe you can start off by walking us through your idea a little bit.
Okay, well, I don't want to repeat a whole lot of information that I've already given out at Sunstone and otherwise, so trying to break new ground here, I'll just give you a really quick overview. Getting on the internet for the first time, talking about Mormonism and so forth, I would hear defenses of Mormonism that were completely different than anything that I had ever heard about in church. For instance, defenders and apologists would say a lot of things like, oh, that's not official doctrine, or that was only the prophet's opinion, or other specifically things such as, oh, Noah's flood only covered it was only a localized thing. It didn't cover the whole planet, and so on and so forth. And that kind of surprised me because those were not concepts that I'd ever heard in church at any time at all. And so I was wondering where they were coming up with some of this stuff, because here you had defenders saying one thing, but then you would hear completely different things in church. For instance, when it comes to Noah's flood, you would hear in church things like, oh, it covered every square inch of the planet because the earth as a living thing, it's also following the plan of salvation, and the flood was a temporal baptism of the earth by water in preparation for the spiritual baptism of the earth by fire. Or you also hear things like, whether by mine own voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same. None of this official doctrine, unofficial doctrine, or ever. Plus, even children in primary hear things like, you know, follow the prophet, he knows the way. None of this follow the prophet, unless you get a spiritual confirmation that what he is saying is indeed official doctrine. Otherwise, go ahead and ignore what he has to say and can strike it up to just advice which may or may not be inspired. So one thing in church, another thing on the internet. So I was kind of befuddled by this. And when you look at ex-Mormon sites, ex-Mormon discussion sites like Recovery from Mormonism, they would say things such as, oh, yeah, well, trying to figure out what Mormon doctrine is sort of like nailing Jell-O to a wall. Which seemed a little bit unfair, in my opinion, because the things you hear in church are pretty consistent. It's only when things get muddled, or things only get muddled on the internet. So one day, assuming that's enough background information, one day it just hit me like a bolt out of the blue, like a strike of lightning. It hit me that the Mormons online and the Mormons in church were members of completely different religions. Now, you might say to yourself, well, wait, that's pretty extreme rhetoric. I mean, what's this whole thing about, you know, different religions? You must be crazy. Well, the reason I have to say it that way is because the idea doesn't really sink in unless I put it in such radical terms. for instance, sure, they all, these different sets of Mormons, they attend church, they share the same buildings, they partake of the sacrament, they revere the same leaders, but their sets of belief are completely and totally at odds in some cases. I must, of course, add the fact that a lot of the basics are, of course, the same, such as, you know, the divinity of Jesus, the importance of baptism, the importance of repentance, the necessity to pay tithing, and so forth. Those things the two groups, of course, have in common, and the critics of the Internet Mormon Chapel Mormon model will, of course, point that out as a refutation of what I'm having to say. But at the same time, you look at some of the specific doctrines that are different between the two groups, and that's where it becomes profitable to kind of categorize these two sets of Mormon thought so that we can kind of understand what it is we're talking about when we encounter these two different brands in their various venues. For example, you take a look at the mainstream Utah church, right? And you also take a look at the Warren Jeffs group down in Texas and Colorado City. Well, there are lots and lots of similarities. For instance, they both revere Joseph Smith as the prophet of the Restoration. They both accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior and so forth. But it's the specific differences that they have that causes them to be considered two different churches. But that's why I also think that it's completely legitimate to identify these two different strands of Mormon thought simply by the differences that these two groups have between them, and not so much the lack of similarity, or not so much the similarities. Does that make any sense at all?
Yes.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. And one of the ways that I interpret the idea, the same person might be in both groups. I think some of the criticism you've received on the idea in the past, they're saying, well, obviously there's not two whole distinct groups, but I don't think that's what you're arguing. For example, somebody might go online and represent the church in a sort of putting it in better light for the outside consumer, which is the whole internet Mormon thing, and then go on Sunday and get up and fast and testimony meeting and get up and give their talks, and they'll represent fully the chapel Mormon, the more conservative, more fundamentalist view. Is that where you're going?
That is absolutely correct. I mean, there's not a single doubt in my mind that, individual Mormons will kind of shift in between these different modes of Mormon thought whenever the necessity arises. For example, let's drop the Internet Mormon Chapel Mormon thing just for a moment, and let's examine a random BYU professor of biology. So you know that he gets up there in front of his classes and he talks all about evolution, he talks about the origin of species and Darwin and so forth. But then when Sunday rolls around, he gets up and he gives his talk about Adam and Eve and the fall of Adam and so forth. And there's no conflict in his mind. I mean, those two things just kind of come naturally, kind of like Orwell's doublethink. So it goes with Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons. I mean, they'll say what they have to say or and so forth, depending on the venue that they're in. So, that's not surprising at all.
Yeah, we got that a lot on the when I was on my mission, especially when you're speaking to people who, are unfamiliar with Mormonism, the goal seemed to be to present Mormonism in a Christian light, so to speak, so that the person is very comfortable with the idea of Mormonism as a just another Christian religion. I think you see that dichotomy in a missionary's effort as well, to where the things that are shown to the non-member are very basic and very bland, forms of Mormonism, the milk before the meat type of thinking. So that, the Mormonism presented to a non-member who is being outed to become a potential member believes that there are two Mormonisms, or that, later comes to accept the more core Mormon beliefs before or after accepting the kind of, generic Christian facade.
Okay, James, I think you're talking about like insider versus outsider knowledge, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, that's a really, really good point. In fact, we see some of that too when apologists try to shoot down the Internet Mormonism versus Chapel Mormon theory. They say that The reason that everybody's not an internet Mormon is because they just simply haven't done their homework. I mean, they haven't read Farms, they haven't read Fair, they haven't studied their religion like they should have done, like they have been disciplined enough to do. But I think that particular, I mean, not yours, Jim, but that particular defense from the apologists and the defenders is illegitimate, simply because if that was true, then the prophets and the apostles are the ones who are uneducated and have not studied their religion. Because everything you hear out of General Conference, everything you hear out of the correlated lesson manual material, it's all chapel Mormon doctrine from top to bottom to front to back. I mean, everything about the whole Mormon experience is simply designed to be a chapel Mormon creation assembly line. It's all about creating and promulgating chapel Mormonism. For instance, Noah's flood covered every square inch of the earth. The Lamanites are the direct ancestors of the American Indians, and so on and so forth. Adam and Eve were the very first human beings, and there was no death before the fall, and so on. It's all chapel Mormon assembly lines. However, it's only the internet Mormons. It is not the prophets and apostles that are promulgating other types of Mormon thought, such as, oh yeah, of course we believe in evolution. Every enlightened Mormon believes in evolution. Or, yeah, Noah's flood was only a local thing. And, of course, there are a whole bunch of Asiatic inhabitants when Lehi's family arrived, and they just assimilated into a group of millions and millions of pre-existing Native Americans. I mean, all that stuff does not come from the prophets and apostles. It comes from the apologists and defenders only.
Yeah, I remember when I started questioning the church actively and having conversations with individuals who I would go to set, kind of say, look, this is a problem for me. You know, I have this problem. How do you solve this in your mind? And I came away very even further confused, because I would be presenting Chapel Mormon questions and getting internet Mormon answers of saying, well, that's not really a problem because we really don't know where the Hill Cumorah was, for instance. I'd turn around and say, every prophet, you know, from Joseph Smith to Hinckley, basically said the Hill Cumorah is in New York, you know. And then you turn around and say, well, no, the Hill Cumorah is in Mesoamerica somewhere, or it's in the Midwest, and you get this sense that, you know, the goalposts keep getting moved in direct conflict to what everything that the church has said officially for the, you know, since its inception.
Right, and that's where we get into the whole dichotomy between internet Mormons and chapel Mormons, because, like we've hit on before, chapel Mormonism has remained quite consistent over the years through the correlated manuals and everything else, but like you just mentioned, it's the apologists and the defenders, when attempting to make the church look good to critics, they're the ones that are, like you said, moving the goalposts and so on.
I just wanted to underline something that both you guys are saying. We're not talking simply about puffery here. You know, when missionaries are out there, they might be doing a little apple shining and making it look really good and the sort of milk before meat. But for a lot of these apologists and internet Mormons, they're pushing out theories that are in conflict with a lot of things that have been said for a lot of years. You know, you've mentioned like the global flood. So those sort of things. I mean, they're proposing doctrines that are extremely different than what has been commonly believed in the pews. And in a lot of ways, they're also very reductionist when it comes to what has been said across the pulpit, saying, well, those guys were just talking as men, that we can't necessarily take the prophet's word for it, which is a real divergence from the way most Mormons view what the brethren are saying.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. The apologists, they're not just, like you said, apple polishing or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, they are deadly serious about everything they're saying. In fact, one of the things that I identified on my website as a phenomena behind it, reflective of this whole thing, is that each group, the Chapel Mormons and Internet Mormons, each group believes that its version of Mormonism is the true Mormonism. And they also view that the other group as being out of step or out of harmony. That, you know,
or uneducated.
Thank you very much. That can't be overstated. Yes, or uneducated.
There is a certain kind of nose in the air mentality when apologists speak of Chapel Mormons. You know, it's it's this air of naivety on the Chapel Mormon by the Internet Mormon.
And one thing that needs to be mentioned, and it should be emphasized every time one of those Internet Mormons talks like that, is the fact that the prophets and the apostles are also uneducated, if the defenders and apologists are to be believed. Because what are the apostles and the prophets doing? They are preaching Chapel Mormonism. In other words, they are the uneducated ones. And if you believe the scriptures, well, looks like God is one of the uneducated ones too. Because apparently, you know, if the Bible's to be believed, God thinks that the flood took covered every square inch of the earth. Otherwise, he wouldn't have told Noah to build an ark. He would have just told him to walk uphill.
Well, that's okay. He was just speaking as a man.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, God was just speaking as a man.
This has been on my mind as I listened to your Stone conference when you combated Michael Ash, and I can't remember some girl on Times and Season, I believe.
Right.
The question that comes to my mind as far as apologists and what their rebuttal is to your claim of categorizing these two different types of Mormons is whether you take some of these things, like you say, the creationism or the flood or whatever else, literal or figurative. And that transition makes a gap, I think. You know, being able to take something that you've always thought was literal, and what the apologists are saying, no, actually there's room and there's a hidden back door that opens that you can actually take it as figurative. What are your response to that, Jason?
Okay, my response to that is, since when have the apostles or the prophets said that there is a back door and that their teachings can be taken as only figurative? Can you imagine Boyd K. Packer sitting up in general conferences and saying, now, brothers and sisters, everything that I have said, there's a back door to it, and you can take it as figurative if you so desire? I mean, can you imagine Boyd K. Packer saying that?
Of course, but what if they respond by saying, well, okay, modern revelation, you know, that was Bruce McConkie or that was Spencer Kimball. We've got modern revelation now, and they're basically saying, as far as I can tell, even in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, where they kind of leave that door open as far as evolution goes, saying, well, the church isn't going to make a stance on that. They may have in the past, but we're not going to take a stance on that, which means in the apologist's mind, well, that keeps that door open that, yeah, you can actually take that figuratively, and it wasn't an actual event. It's something that's kind of a legend of sorts.
Okay, now I'm glad you brought that up, because that is an extremely good point that you're making. And my response to that is that even some of the prophets and apostles and correlation committee or whoever's in charge, some of them are even beginning to see the writing on the wall. You know, and evolution is probably the biggest issue. So they can see that the tack that previous apostles have taken in general conference and elsewhere has just been untenable, that the evidence in favor of evolution is so completely overwhelming that they would look rather foolish to, you know, downplay it or deny it. So they have no choice but to kind of keep silent about it and just say, oh yeah, we have no official position, and kind of hoping that everybody forgets about everything that has been compiled in previous conference reports and Deseret books and so forth. So yeah, sometimes, like I said, there's the writing is on the wall, but they kind of back off and hope that nobody notices. They don't come out and say, oh, by the way, everybody, guess what? We were wrong about this. Another example is when the issue of birth control. Remember that? Back when we were all kids, birth control was considered a sin. But now in the current Church Handbook of Instructions, it's a personal choice made between the couple and the Lord. Of course, that hasn't been trumpeted aloud over the pulpit in general conference saying, oh, hey, guess what? We were wrong about this. It's now your own show. They just kind of hide it in a little nook and cranny and hope that nobody really notices.
So, this is Niall. Are you implying that there's some kind of actual direction of revelation from Internet Mormonism to Chapel Mormonism?
I don't know if it's a revelation per se, but I would say that when it comes to general trends, especially when it comes to science and other social trends such as the economic reality of a woman needing to work outside the home, even the top leadership will kind of get the hint, and they'll just sort of back off on some of their more hardcore Chapel Mormon teachings.
Here's another way to phrase that. If there's a branch of the church according to this theory, which side is actually leading the church? Is it the Internet side or is it the chapel side?
Oh, I would say it's definitely the chapel side, but the Internet Mormon side is probably what you may see in like the next 50 years or so.
You know, that's a good point. And to take a step back, the apologist might have a really good point here. If you think about it, the leadership position of the church is an administrative position. These are men that have been vetted from their years of experience being bishops, stake presidents, usually mission presidents. They tend to have backgrounds in law, in business, and because the church is a big corporation, I'm not saying that in a negative way. They own property. They have thousands of employees, billions of dollars that they have to move around and do all sorts of things with. And then they have to deal with all the problems and the problems of personnel and scandals and all the things they have to handle. In the Mormon church, we don't train people to be theologians, and that's part of the charm of it, I guess. So in a sense, I think I've heard apologists argue this before, we put too much weight on their shoulders, expecting them to be able to drive the church doctrinally. You know, in the past, we had Joseph Fielding Smith and those sort of guys who spent their life sort of devoted to that. That's just not in the cards anymore. So, you know, maybe we're asking too much.
I've got a response to that, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
You say that it might be too much. Well, my response is, if these folks are really being led by God, and if Christ is really at the helm of this church, why can't God just come down and say, okay, at tomorrow's general conference, you will say A, B, and C? I mean, how hard is that? I mean, that's only going to take like about, 5 minutes out of their day.
Well, yeah, Shades, I think that's a good take, because to your traditional Mormon, there's a certain power bestowed on the leaders that, you know, that the experience normally gained through studying theology and to capture that kind of ideal of an active theologian is bestowed on the leader by the rights, of gaining authority in the church. You know, there's a personality cult, you know, to use the term, that believes that these leaders are guided and directed by the Spirit in a very supercharged manner that gives them almost special abilities. And that counters the fact that most of the people in the church are lay clergy, would fit the definition of lay clergy.
Okay, now that's a fantastic point, but Niall just came up with is yet another example of the divergence between Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons. Because what do we hear in church, we hear in General Conference? Well, we hear that prophets and apostles were special men that are selected by God thanks to their overwhelming integrity and honesty and moral uprightness in order to receive revelation from God, possibly even see Christ, and then tell the world what Christ would have the world or the church be told. I mean, that's
if
what
you
we
have
hear.
The right pedigree.
Well, yeah, if you have the right pedigree. Okay, but that's what we hear, and that's what the Chapel Mormons tell us. That's what the apostles tell us, the prophets tell us. That's what we hear in church, is it not? But now, Niall, you just came up with an Internet Mormon idea, which is, oh, well, that's just too much weight to put on their shoulders. These guys are just administrators. They can't be bothered with getting revelation from God because they're too busy, you know, bogged down with the minutiae of just running a day-to-day organization. So since when have the prophets or the apostles stood up in General Conference and said, hey, look, you know, stop expecting so much out of us. We're just administrators, nothing more. To expect us to reveal knowledge, to expect us to be theologians is just, you know, too much to expect from us. So just lay off, will you?
What about that as far as the claim that, you know, most of these Chapel Mormons actually believe that their leaders or even the prophet sees Christ or talks to Christ or gets direct inspiration or revelation from God? And the fact that they don't talk about it, isn't that, because I've heard this claim before, that the reason why that they don't get that, or they don't get out and say, okay, you know, God just told me this for the church, is because, you know, God gives their prophet and apostles and even all of us our space, our free agency. And even if Christ met with President Monson and said, you know, X, Y, and Z, you need to watch for this, that experience is so sacred that we obviously wouldn't hear about it. That's kind of the response I would hear from that, right?
I think that response is kind of disingenuous because, you know, when I was growing up in the church and you know, communicating with other Mormons, it's almost a given to them that Jesus Christ and Elohim walked through the temple, you know, at night and talk to the leaders of the church, but they don't talk about it because they're not supposed to. You know, it's, I don't know, there's just something that doesn't sit right with me about that idea.
Okay, Tom, I hope I understood your question correctly, but if you look at the early church, let's say, you know, Joseph Smith, I mean, take a look at the Doctrine and Covenants. It is full of nothing but revelations from God through Joseph Smith, you know, giving direction about some point of doctrine or where some member needs to go on his mission the next spring or whatever the case may be. You know, way back in the day, Joseph Smith had no problems whatsoever receiving revelation from God and claiming as much. But nowadays, it seems to me that if they are no longer upon that particular point, they have probably just become honest enough that they realize that they shouldn't go around saying something that's not true.
Either that, or they can use that as it, that was a sacred experience, and I just don't feel like I want to divulge it to everybody. And maybe back in the day that was required of them because that's when the church was starting or something. I don't know. I'm just trying to think and trying to respond how I know an apologist would, or how I've when I've asked that question, that's the answer that I usually have got.
Well, of course, that's what the apologist would say, of course, because there isn't a whole lot of speeches or talks that could be tagged as direct revelation from the Savior. So, you know, what else are they supposed to say? I mean, if it was Chapel Mormons, they don't, once again, they don't follow that particular tack. They say, follow the prophet, follow the prophet. He knows the way. You know, a prophet receives direct revelation from God and so forth. So, you know, here you are saying that, well, it's probably too to talk about. That's why we don't hear about it much anymore, which kind of sounds Internet Mormonish to me. But the Chapel Mormons are hearing the exact same lessons in church that we did back when we were kids, right?
Right.
So there we go, right. Back to square one.
But it does leave that vagueness, you know, where it's left up to the individual person whether they actually believe that the prophet actually sees and speaks with Christ himself visually or audibly. It's still kind of ambiguous to a certain extent, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, it's ambiguous. And,
think,
of course, it has to be.
I think it's ambiguous by design.
Sure, sure, I agree.
I disagree. I don't see this as ambiguous at all. Like, the first job description point of a prophet is for you to A, see and talk to God, and B, tell people what you've heard. To stand up and sustain Thomas S. Monson as a prophet, seer, and revelator, and he's never seen God, never done anything that you can't do in your bathroom right now, I think that's amazingly disingenuous.
So, Niall, where do you get that definition? I mean, you're defining, you're kind of boxing in what a prophet has to be. Where do you think that comes from, the box you're putting it in?
Well, find me a prophet anywhere in the scriptures where they said, well, I went and I prayed and I just felt this still strong voice that Jerusalem's going to be destroyed by a giant whale. It's just not happening. They get up on a wall, they start shouting, they start saying, I saw God. God told me this. I had a vision. This is going to happen if you don't do this. That's what a prophet does. A leader or an inspired person can do other things, but you don't stand up and sustain the president of the church as a leader. You stand him up as a prophet.
I'd have to agree with Niall. I mean, during the course of the missionary discussions, during the first lesson that we would give to individuals, what is a prophet? Well, a prophet is somebody who talks to God and then, you know, like you said, Niall, spreads that message, which then sets it up to, you know, the discussion of Joseph Smith. I think it's part of, you know, this, what Niall is bringing to as a definition of a prophet is systemic in Mormonism.
To this point, I want to bring this point up because it kind of bugs me personally, but I don't know if any of you have actually met a general authority, either when you were a believer or when you weren't, but sometimes they're treated a little bit like a celebrity. And just like if you're in a meeting where an apostle is going to be there, the whole audience has got to stand up before he comes in. Then when he leaves, everyone's got to stand up to like show respect or honor. There is kind of that divide and that imply that they're kind of a little above the normal average member, right? And I think that kind of plays on the average member's psyche that, you know, maybe there's more than, maybe he's not just more spiritual than me. Maybe he does diverse with the spirits or the angels or God himself on the other side. Don't you think?
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's part of the mystique. And if these folks were just inspired or overburdened administrators, then would we see that sort of celebrity?
And you see the same operation in business, too. I mean, you know, I work for a very large corporation, and when I meet with individuals that, you know, are significantly a higher rank, there is a bit of pomp and circumstance that comes with that. You know, there's a certain section of time, you know, dedicated to talk to this individual. There's certain requirements and certain preparation must be taken. And there is a celebrity cult, you know, very minor in kind of necessary, you know, in to a certain degree in an organization such as a large corporation.
It's probably in our DNA to do that sort of thing, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I would think so.
I think it just kind of, I don't know, maybe it's just my new mindset, but I remember on my mission where the missionaries would show pictures how they had met this apostle or this general authority, and they bragged about it to everyone. Like it was, you know, like it was Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie, for crying out loud. It bugs me now. I guess it didn't at the time, but it bugs me now.
Yeah, here's something else that sort of bugged me, if we're on the topic of, you know, what bugs us about general authorities, is that whenever a new general authority is called, what's the first thing they do is they immediately churn out some book in the Deseret Book and make who knows how much money. I mean, Neil A. Maxwell, he churned out it. I did a count one time, and it turns out that of the apostles that were in office at the time, they had written an average of 4 books each since becoming apostles. And it's like, boy, somebody's really riding this GA gravy train. You know, you look at Chieko Okazaki. Oh my gosh, she has so many tapes, so many books and things. It's like, wow, how much money is she making off the gospel? Same with Paul H. Dunn.
Paul H. Dunn.
I mentioned in the introduction that the FAIR website, now FAIR is an apologetic organization and kind of to our whole point of this discussion, which exists only online. They have a webpage devoted to this topic and to you. And I want to quote a little bit from that. Most of the issues that Jason thought showed a difference between Internet Mormons and Chapel Mormons are not fundamental to Mormon belief. For example, the following questions are topics of debate among believing Latter-day Saints and not matters upon which anyone ought to base their testimony. And they say Mormonism and science, who are the Lamanites, belief or disbelief in evolution, the extent of Noah's flood, and the location of Hill Cumorah, they name. Now, I want to point out a couple things I think are interesting there. First of all, they speak with authority in that. They say, these are not fundamental to Mormon belief, and anyone ought not to base their testimony of the restored gospel on these things. And then they proceed to list a bunch of issues that were always important to me and that I spent a lot of time struggling over myself. So maybe you can comment on that quote.
I would love to comment on that quote. Now, boiling it down to the bare bones, they are correct that such a tangential to the question of whether or not Jesus Christ was resurrected, you know, whether or not there is a celestial kingdom and so forth. I mean, like, they are correct, and I can't emphasize that enough. However, when you take all those particular questions in sum, there is a divergence between what the prophets and apostles say versus what, you know, FAIR and their ilk say. So it's not so much that those questions are important, either by themselves or as a whole. The question is whether or not the prophets are reliable. On each thing that they listed, prophets and apostles have come down clearly and unambiguously on one side of the equation or the other. But yet here they're saying that's the only tangential. So the thing at issue is not the individual points themselves, it's whether or not the prophets and apostles can be relied upon to teach the truth. That's what the whole Internet Mormon, Chapel Mormon thing boils down to. Are the prophets reliable? And on those particular aspects, yeah, there is a definite divergence. The prophets have said one thing and clearly and unambiguously, but yet the Internet Mormons have chosen to discount that anyway. That's what it boils down to.
To me, it sounds more like a straw man argument in that he's saying that these concepts aren't critical to Mormonism. I don't think that this theory ever maintains that one or the other is not Mormonism. Both Internet and Chapel are both Mormons.
Okay, they're all okay. Yeah, well, sure, they're all Mormons. I mean, just like any other religion, you're gonna see some kind of spectrum, a divergence of thought, or you know, a divergence of ideas as to what constitutes Mormonism, you know, might vary from individual to individual. But assuming I'm understanding you correctly, well, once again, it goes back to whether or not the prophets can be relied upon to teach the truth.
I guess where I was going with that is just, it seems like a strange thing to criticize that these things, to maintain that things like Noah's Flood and such like that isn't critical to your belief in Mormonism. It has nothing to do with the actual theory. Other than the point you bring up as whether or not the prophet is reliable or not. But aside from that, it really doesn't have anything to do with it. All you are trying to describe is that there are some Mormons who accept it and some Mormons who don't. You're not saying they're not Mormons. If Fair wanted to destroy this theory, I think there's a number of angles that they could have taken. And I'm just a little shocked that they took sort of holding these things up as saying, well, we never said that you need to believe in the Flood to be Mormon.
Right. Yes, you know, yeah, that's another thing you're absolutely correct upon. But you just said that if they're trying to destroy my theory, they should have taken a different tack. Well, I can pretty much guarantee you that apologists and defenders of Mormonism are so angry at me for coming up with this dichotomy that they've pretty much used any argument they could to destroy this thing. You know, that's just one of the many avenues that they've taken. So, part of it, or one of their tactics, is to minimize it, or to, you know, reduce it to a straw man just by, you know, saying something like that, you know, avoiding the big picture while just, you know, focusing on the, you know, nitpicking.
Yeah, I've always been a little confused as to why they're so, at least some of them are so critical of this idea. You know, before we did this podcast, I listened to your Sunstone presentation again, and it was interesting because you spoke at the Sunstone Symposium, and then there were three speakers who followed explaining why this dichotomy didn't make any sense, and the dichotomy wasn't useful, and the taxonomy was all wrong. And then for the rest of the discussion, everybody involved just assumed that the dichotomy was right. They just followed right in. It's something to me that makes a fundamental amount of sense, that there is clearly one set of Mormonism that's being pushed out there by the apologists, and there's another one that is back in the field. And, you know, Shades, you're not the only one who has been pushing this. John Charles Duffy, of course, has been arguing more formally for quite some time that, you know, the apologists are pushing the doctrine, some of the things we've been talking about this last hour, that they are the ones driving the boat when it comes to where we're going, and that the general authorities, as they are right now, are just kind of sitting back and letting it happen and speaking in ambiguities and not making doctrinal distinction.
I think with the Sunstone presentation and listening to that, they phrased the arguments in Internet Mormon language, and so, you know, thus saying this dichotomy doesn't exist, but at the same time framing the language, you know, within Internet Mormonism at the same time.
Hey, Jason, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask some questions that's kind of related to what we've been talking about, and kind of to hear your rebuttal from the apologists in respect to, like, during your Sunstone, Michael Ash actually accused you of your motive for this categories of Internet and Chapel Mormons. What was your motive behind it? Because he accuses you of being a highly anti-Mormon or critic. What would be your response to that, to what your motive was to design this essay or these two categories, and to rebut what your motive was for this?
Okay, my motive, it was very, very simple. It was not to tear down anything. My motive was simply and only to understand just what the heck it was I was hearing. Because, yes, the things that I would hear, and I'm sure all the rest of us have heard on the internet, were so completely and totally different than what we hear in church. What can you be other than confused when you hear all these different things? I mean, I was raised my whole life hearing A, but yet here I am on the internet, and everybody seems to accept B. You know, how could that be? And my only motive was just to simply understand what in the world is going on. And as soon as it hit me that we're talking about two different religions here, then everything fell into place perfectly. Everything made complete and total sense. And my only, you know, back to your question, my only motive was just to understand, to make heads or tails of, and to, comprehend what it was we're dealing with.
Do you consider yourself an anti-Mormon or a highly aggressive, angry critic to the church?
No, I consider myself a critic of Mormonism, but rather than being called an anti-Mormon, I probably have to be called an anti-Mormonism, because I have absolutely nothing against the people whatsoever, but I just think that there are certain aspects of Mormonism that the leadership withholds and otherwise sweeps under the rug that people really do deserve to hear about. So that's part of the reason for, you know, my website, MormonInformation.com, to be, you know, online, and also to a lesser extent for Mormon Discussions to be online, is for some of these things that you can't hear in church to be accessible and available to people who, you know, want to find out about some of this stuff. Nothing else. I'm a critic, yeah. Would I get if the church came out and was honest about a lot of this stuff? Yeah, sure I would. But anti-Mormon implies that I have something against the people, which I definitely do not.
Dr. Shades, why why not a spectrum? It seems like a spectrum would be a better descriptor.
Okay, that is a fantastic question, and yes, I will be absolutely the first person to admit that, yes, there is a spectrum. I mean, you have extreme Chapel Mormonism on one end and Internet Mormonism on the other, but pretty much the rank and file, you know, falls somewhere in between. Like, for instance, I can believe that, you know, evolution took place, but I can also believe that the Hill Cumorah was in New York and not Mesoamerica. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, cherry-picking, you know, one of each. So, yeah, you are absolutely correct. There is a spectrum. However, it helps to have words for something. I mean, all words in any language are reductionistic to some extent. So the more words you have, the greater your thought is expanded. And conversely, the fewer words you have, the more thought is contracted. Like if any of you have read George Orwell's 1984, you have the whole concept of newspeak, where words were constantly deleted from the dictionary in order to reduce people's width and expanses of thought. So I think that, yes, you are correct, there is a spectrum, but it's better to have more words than fewer words.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, that's a lot like Chomsky, you know, has taught, is that language defines the way that we think, and, you know, different language can cause different ways of thinking.
Oh, yeah. So, Niall, does that answer your question?
Yeah. I have one more question, and I think I can sort of pipe down here.
Go ahead.
I'm sort of liking this theory the more I think about it. But the $1,000 question here is, why is this useful?
Okay, it's useful simply to understand what it is that's being taught. For example, if I see somebody saying, oh yeah, Adam and Eve were the first human beings and there was no death before the fall, I can say, oh yeah, that's a Chapel Mormon belief. Whereas if somebody is saying, oh yeah, the Hill Cumorah was in Mesoamerica and Joseph Smith was simply wrong about everything he taught, I can say, oh yeah, well, that's an Internet Mormon belief. So I can kind of know what exactly is being taught over the pulpit and at church versus what I'm seeing and hearing on the Internet. So it's just convenience, that's all.
Have you thought about expanding on the essay by doing, okay, because I like your essay and I like what you said, but focus more on, okay, so if you're a Chapel Mormon and you take things literal, you fall into this gap, and then it's a matter of where you go from there. Well, if you want to continue to be a Mormon, then you've got to jump into this internet Mormon category, or liberal Mormon, or apologist kind of mindset, or you church, right? Have you ever thought about expanding on that?
Well, I haven't really thought about expanding on it that much, because sometimes too many cooks spoil the broth, you know that old saying. So rather than water it down, I just decided to keep it, you know, as simple and as easily accessible as possible. However, the point that you just made, I did in fact touch on that a little bit at the very, very end of the essay. And let me go ahead and quote this. I said, whenever a Mormon is confronted with controversial and contradictory historical information, which he or she can no longer simply ignore, he or she has one of two choices, either apostatize or convert to Internet Mormonism. I think that is pretty much, you know, hard-hitting enough that it doesn't need to be expanded upon that much without losing some of its impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's powerful, is that, I mean, when I first heard about, you know, your theories about Internet Mormons versus Chapel Mormons, it seemed that Internet Mormonism is one step closer to apostasy than, you know, Chapel Mormonism. It's the middle ground. It's the waiting area for when you either leave the church or stay an Internet Mormon. I don't think there's any – you can't go back to Chapel Mormonism once you commit yourself to Internet Mormonism.
Oh, I would totally agree with that. I don't necessarily see Internet Mormonism as a way station on the road to apostasy, with apostasy being the final destination. Because if you look at some of these Internet Mormons, take a look at the Mad Board for a great collection of those. I mean, those people are just as hardcore, quasi-fanatical as any one of your hardcore believers you would find in the chapel. You look at the Mad Board, especially some of the more prominent defenders, and none of them look like they're anywhere near apostatizing. So I would think that that's just another form of Mormonism as opposed to a way station on the apostasy. So forgive me if I contradicted you, but that's
just my point of view. Would you think that it was a way to kind of step out outside of the church, for at least in your mind, and still stay in? What I'm saying is it's a way to feel comfortable about the contradictions with your feet still in the water, per se.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, because I agree with that absolutely. I'm pretty sure that the hierarchy and the brethren and so forth, to the extent that they know about Internet Mormonism and what's going on the Internet, I think that they tolerate it just because of the fact that it's providing members with a way of staying in rather than, leaving and taking their tithing money with them. So as I've said, a lot earlier, church and general conference are nothing more than Chapel Mormon assembly lines. But if somebody has fallen off the conveyor belt, they would far rather assume that they or as soon they Internet Mormonism and keep the tithing coming in rather than just leave entirely. So, yeah.
I think there's a really good point there. I think what we're talking about is method of contextualization. Let's say something like the theory of evolution. Anybody who's seriously studied it, I mean, for the most part, is going to accept the theory, and then they have to recontextualize. So some will say, hey, this contradicts everything. I'm out. I'm done. Others will take more of a sunstone route and take a really sort of liberal view of religion. The religion is more of metaphors and models. But some have to kind of keep holding on to that more traditional view, and that's where the apologetic sort of Internet Mormonism comes in, where they have to come up with this new theory to try to contextualize, say, Joseph Fielding Smith, where he said flat out, evolution is incorrect. They have to find a way to sort of like bubble that off and keep their belief. So in a sense, it's just another form of holding on to or dealing with information.
Absolutely. And earlier we talked about how Internet Mormons will say that Chapel Mormons haven't studied their religion or aren't familiar with their religion or haven't done the required homework or legwork. Well, in that implication is that the Internet Mormons have come across information or have dealt with information, such as, like you just said, evolution. Just by nature, the fact that they imply that they've studied more must mean that they've come across these controversial and tough-to-swallow things that cause them to convert to Internet Mormonism.
Yeah, I found that most apologists, when they discuss their own history, they've come to some sort of crisis in faith at some point. So there's some who go the New Order Mormon route, some leave the church, and some become apologists, I guess, but there's no going back.
Oh, no, I don't think so either. I think somebody else touched on this earlier, but one really, really funny thing that I've noticed is that if somebody else comes up with this Internet Mormons versus Chapel Mormons concept, like if it's a believing Mormon and they give it different labels or different names, all the apologists, they jump on it and they think it's the neatest thing since sliced bread, and they assume that it's the most self-evidently obvious thing that they've ever heard in their lives. But if it comes from me, oh my gosh, it's terribly false and it must be rejected and you're just a filthy anti-Mormon out to destroy the church and so forth. So it's just, it never ceases to amaze me how, like Tom was saying, it's if it comes from me, it's bad, but then they go around and talk as though it was self-evident and a given.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. The anti-Mormons are the anti-Mormons, so there's no getting around that.
Exactly.
One thing I'd like to say is, just to touch on about this topic, is I question how genuine the Internet Mormons are in their defense mechanisms, by stating that the prophet is only speaking as a man, etc. Inside every Internet Mormon, I believe, is just a Chapel Mormon waiting to come back.
I don't know.
Yeah, in this, they want to believe that the Hill Cumorah is in New York and not, in some, unknown location that we will find in the future. they want to believe that, but they're stuck between the world of rational thought and Mormon thinking.
Yeah, so it's so Internet Mormonism is a compromise between the real world and what they hear the prophets and apostles teaching.
Right, but it's only an extension, a tool to bring out when they're losing an argument.
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. I'm sure it was the whole Internet Mormon thing was almost developed in response to criticism.
Thanks, everybody, for participating tonight. This has been a really great discussion. And Jason, Dr. Shades, we're going to have you come back sometime. This was really fun.
I would love to come back. I had a great time.
Remember, the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. Check out that blog for links to the information we discussed, including links to Dr. Shades' website. And remember that you can call and leave your comment at 801-906-6722 or email at mail@MormonExpression.com, and we'll be happy to play your audio right here on the podcast. You can also email comments for future podcasts. Our music is provided by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. And we'll see you all next time.
Thank you.